Well, welcome everybody. Alchemist Kitchen talking about the road between enlightenment and alchemy.
Maybe people will realize as we get into further the whole realm of alchemy that actually has a long and amazing history in the West. And the Renaissance, leaving aside Chinese and Egyptian alchemy, etc., and Arabic alchemy, just looking at it in the West. Is the sound coming through okay?
Yeah.
So I've done a 21-year series of conferences called Esoteric Quests. We just did the last one a few weeks ago in Iceland. That one was on the, that was an esoteric quest for the mysteries of the North in Iceland. So we were deeply into the world of Norse mythology. Some of the most sacred and remote parts of Iceland, and there's part of my psyche that is still there. But this this series began in 1995. Actually, I should show you the book that came out of it. Go ahead with me. Yeah, this book, The Rosicrucian Enlightenment Revisited. Came out of the first two conferences in 95 and 97. That's exactly what the first title was called. That was it, the Rosicrucian Enlightenment Revisited. The second one in Prague was called Prague Alchemy and the Hermetic Tradition. And so what these conferences are about is bringing back the Western esoteric tradition in a living, vibrant way, not associated with some strange occult group that thinks it is, you know, it's a series of masters and initiates who've got it all down. But in a realistic, grounded, fun, and scholarly in a good way without it being crass or, you know, materialistic, but it certainly has plenty of intellectual rigor around it. So yeah, these first two conferences, 95 and 97, and the first one was held in a place called Český Krumlov. Yeah, and Jonas here was there. He's one of... It's amazing. We still have people who were at the very first one back in 1995, which was, as has been said, the southern Bohemian Mecca of alchemists. Who knew there was a Mecca of alchemists? But there was. Yes, indeed. And who knew, too, that that would seed a 21-year series and counting as enough esoteric quests for him to keep on going to the rest of this incarnation. For me, I'm way beyond, that's for sure. So, Český Krumlov. Yes. I was, let's see. We don't have a little... I'm going to see if I can move this. Český Krumlov is southern Bohemian Mecca of alchemists. Entirely unknown, almost entirely unknown in the Western world up until about 20 years ago when we did our event there. It was hidden behind the Iron Curtain for 60 years. It was in Czechoslovakia, which had the most Stalinist of all the communist governments. The good thing about that is that it was never Disneyfied. If it had been in the West, you can bet it would have been commercialized in some way. But I stumbled across it way back in the early 90s in the immediate aftermath of communism. I was traveling with a friend from Bavaria, and been at a conference in Bavaria, east of Munich. And I said, well, why don't we go to Czechoslovakia? But nobody ever went there, because it was not only a political Iron Curtain, it was a psychic Iron Curtain, too. People just didn't know, they were frightened, they were weird. Who knew how they'd be received? And as I say, it was the most Stalinist after 1968 of all the communist governments in North Korea. And anyway, we set off one afternoon, crossed the Czech border, traveled through the Somava Mountains, these strange, remote, forested hills and lakes. It was all very dark. We had no idea where we were. And then late in the evening, around 11 o'clock one night, we descended into this valley. And there was this little town nestled in the Somava Mountains. We crossed this old stone bridge under an archway, turned a corner down through the cobbled streets. It's an old yellow lighting. It was like something out of another century. The streets were deserted. The place had a vibe unlike anything I'd really ever encountered. I would have to rate it as arguably the most magical vibe I have ever come across. We went on and we're thinking, oh no, where are we? I mean, what century is this? Have we gone through some kind of time warp here? And then we turned a corner and suddenly there was a big wooden bridge. And we crossed the bridge over the river and there's this huge castle rising up out of nowhere. We're going, wow, what is this? And so nobody spoke a word of English in those days. It's right after communism, so people only spoke Czech, Russian, and German, but the person I was traveling with was German, so she was able to translate, otherwise I would have understood nothing. And so in the morning, in this old 16th century building where we found a place to stay, I went down to the breakfast room, and in the breakfast room, red roses were painted all around the walls. I thought, wow, what is this? When I threw open the big casement windows in the morning, the walls were like 5 feet thick. You threw open the windows, you could hear the rushing of the Vltava River down below. You could hear the crying, the singing of birds, and you could see this mysterious hermetic tower in the distance. I was like, wow, what is this? And then we made our way up to the castle that we'd seen when we crossed that bridge. And lo and behold, it turned out to be the castle of Count Wilhelm Rosenberg, the second largest castle in the whole Czech lands. I'll show you a picture here. Any of you who've been to Prague know that Prague, the Hradčany Palace in Prague, is the far and away the largest castle in the Czech lands. But this was the second largest, owned by Wilhelm Rosenberg, a major count, a margrave, or borgrave, I think it was even, in the Habsburg world, the highest level of aristocracy. And he and his brother, Petr Vok, had great lands in the south of Bohemia. And the more I learned about Wilhelm Rosenberg, the more I realized, wow, I have stepped inadvertently, without any knowledge that this would happen, into one of the most beautiful and best preserved esoteric locations on the face of the planet. And nobody knew anything about it. So the more I looked into it, the more I said, yes, Wilhelm Rosenberg was a practicing alchemist. He invited alchemists from all over Europe. If any of these names will mean anything to you, he and his brother Petr Vok were protectors of John Dee. I mean, John Dee is probably the one you're most likely to have heard of. He was the Anglo-Welsh esotericist who was the leader of the Elizabethan Renaissance at the time of Queen Elizabeth. And when they found an effigy of Queen Elizabeth in Southwark in South London with various pin needles in it, it was a little Elizabethan voodoo. Who did they call? Who are you going to call? You're going to call John Dee at that time. And and also, when it came time for the coronation of Queen Elizabeth, very fraught times, extremely intense between Catholics and Protestants, invasion, danger, intrigues, burnings at the stake, a nightmare of intrigue and horror in many ways, but intense and brilliant at the same time. Anyway, it was John Dee who constructed the horoscope for the coronation of Queen Elizabeth. But he was a mathematician, a brilliant mathematical mind. It was his mathematical researches that made a lot of the Elizabethan navigations. You know, Sir Francis Drake is the first person to circumnavigate the globe and get back alive, unlike Magellan. So he was responsible for a lot of the breakthroughs in navigational mathematics that made that all possible. And he was the intellectual leader of the Elizabethan Renaissance for many years, actually. He was a close friend of Sir Walter Raleigh. We've all heard of Sir Walter Raleigh, haven't we?
the guy who brought tobacco. That's his unfortunate legacy, that he brought tobacco back to the New World. But Sir Walter Raleigh was a truly remarkable person. He wrote The History of the World, which is filled with references to Hermes Trismegistus, thrice great Hermes, author of the Emerald Tablet of Hermes Trismegistus. Every hippie in California knew in the 1970s one line from the Emerald Tablet: as above, so below. What on earth did it mean? But of course, it was speaking about the relationship between the macrocosm and the microcosm, between the cosmos out there and the inner essence of the human being. So I realized Chesky Cromlov was an amazing place. And I realized that I had stepped straight into the pages of a great book, The Rosicrucian Enlightenment, written by Francis Yates. Francis Yates was reading the history of the Renaissance at the Warburg Institute at London University for years. She was one of those women who's, if it hadn't been for the First World War, you know, these amazing older spinster women, for want of a better phrase, that's what they were called then, who, you know, their husbands, the people who would have been husbands had been killed in the horrors of the First World War, the stupidities of the trenches. But she devoted her life to scholarship, incredibly knowledgeable, and she single-handedly brought back this epoch that she named the Rosicrucian Enlightenment. You don't normally put Rosicrucian and Enlightenment together in the same phrase. You think of the Enlightenment of the 18th century and the rationalism and so on, and Rosicrucian you think of as having some weird esoteric thing. But but she brought it all together and named this epoch, the late 16th, early 17th century, the Rosicrucian Enlightenment in Central Europe. So that's why this first conference was actually named, was done in honor of her. It was called, the same title as the book, The Rosicrucian Enlightenment Revisited, a conference in honor of Francis Yates. Because even though she's a more controversial figure today in academic circles, and you know, and some of her scholarship may have been incorrect. I mean, she didn't speak all, even though she was spoke multiple languages in those days before the end of the Cold War. Very few people in the West, unless they were specialists, spoke Czech or Polish or the Eastern European languages. So that whole realm was unavailable to her. So she probably ascribes too great a significance to John Dee, the Elizabethan magus we were talking about, for his role in the Rosicrucian Manifesto. It's because we will have heard, those of us who are familiar with the term, the Pharma Fraternitatis, the Confessio in 1614, the Pharma Fraternitatis in 1615, and then something else even more mysterious, the Chemical Wedding of Christian Rosenkreuz, this mysterious tale. And we once spent a day at the Open Center way back when, probably 20 years ago, with Jocelyn Godwin, for those of you who know the Western esoteric tradition, he's one of our greatest living writers on this. But we did a whole day and we read the Chemical Wedding. We lay on the floor, a dozen of us, and Jocelyn just read the Chemical Wedding of Christian Rosenkreuz to us the whole day. It was a great day. It was actually, rather than doing the explication, it was great just to take it in and listen, because of course alchemical refers to alchemical. So we're talking about this time here where it's a turning point in the history of the world, a forgotten turning point in the history of the world. Because up to that point, when it came to medicine, people still just had the old Galenist approach. You know, there were the four humors, the phlegmatic, the sanguine, etc., the melancholic. Everything just operated out of the four humors. Nobody at that point had really thought, or very few up until Paracelsus had really thought, maybe we can actually do something with this. Maybe we can actually work with substances and actually start to benefit human well-being and health. So today we hear a lot of talk about substances. They tend to be psychedelic at the Alchemist's Kitchen. But in those days it was substances just to work with chemistry. It was the last epoch in a way, and that's why it's so moving and so significant. In a sense, this is the birth of these esoteric quests. It was the last time when magic and science were truly connected. And spirituality and science were really part of that same worldview. I'll talk more later about
how the alchemists actually approached their laboratory. But I'll just say that for these alchemists that we're talking about, who gathered around Willem Rosenberg, alchemy was a deep, deep practice. This nonsense that it was just about turning lead into gold, you know, some kind of cheap hustler trying to make a fast buck or something. I mean, nothing could be further from the truth. It was a profound, profound spiritual practice in which, as above, so below, because they were hermetic philosophers, the alchemists, they believed that the outer world that we can perceive with our senses is a reflection or is deeply connected to the inner world of the soul. And so if you go, it's not like today, where if you're doing a scientific experiment, you know, you put on your white coat, maybe you have a cigarette, you go into the lab, you're just trying to replicate the results from before. Whereas for the alchemists, it was a serious practice. It was done in a state of deep piety and deep reverence. And it was not just about chemistry and the material world, nor was it just about the transmutation of, you know, of the individual, but it was also about a massive social, cultural, spiritual transformation of the whole culture. The great alchemists of this time, including people like Count Michael Mayer, who was physician to the Holy Roman Emperor Rudolf II, and Sendivogius, the great Polish alchemist of the time, they all believed that there was the possibility of a new world dawning. And so, yeah, we have to take it out of just the lab, think of it on both those levels. Now, if you go to Prague today, all the tour guides will just show you this little avenue called the Alchemist's Lane or the Alchemist's Alley, whatever they call it. Its only real significance is that Franz Kafka lived there for a while. Actually, that's not where the alchemists were. If you, next time you're in Prague, go to the Belvedere Palace. And in the Belvedere Palace, which is part of a whole larger complex of the Freischalden Palace, you want to look for where the alchemists' laboratories were. Remember our friend Hermes Trismegistus, thrice great Hermes, as above, so below. So when you go to the actual alchemical tower, you will see that on the lower level, was the laboratorio, where the actual physical alchemy was done. But then above it was the oratorio of the spiritual alchemy, this practice. And these two were really pretty indistinguishable. They were two sides of the same coin. Any questions so far? Or should we just keep on trucking?
I have a question. Yes. Did this influence Foster Case and the Order of the Golden Dawn and some of the...
Well, I'm no authority on Foster Case and the Golden Dawn, but I'm sure it did. Anybody who looked seriously at this period had to realize that this was a major, major rebuff. It was the high realm of esoteric spirituality. Before we went into the 30 Years' War, so, I mean, I couldn't tell you the details, but any serious student of Western esotericism, like Waite and so on, is going to have known all about this. Not as much as Frances Yates, because Frances Yates, she was not an esoteric, she was an academic. But obviously she had an open mind. She didn't buy into anything esoteric necessarily, but she just could see that there was a brilliant and amazing period that had been completely forgotten. So she excavated it. You know, the Warburg Institute at London University uses, I would call it a holistic approach to research, and it's not just textually based. It's not just text. They're looking at pictures and imagery all the time. As we'll see, the alchemists, many of them, particularly Michael Mayer and Heinrich Kunrath and others, were great practitioners, great artists, or they worked with engravers. They must have given the design, and then they worked with engravers who were able to produce beautiful, haunting, mysterious imagery. So that was the situation there. Now why this, let me give you a bit of the political background here, because that's how Francis Yates' book begins. You know, when we look at these esoteric things, we tend to look at them in isolation without really grasping the politics of it all. Well, so this is the late 16th to early 17th century. Remember, Protestants and Catholics are at each other's throats. You've had Luther in Germany. You've had Henry VIII, who has declared at the end of the Catholic Church, pronounced that he himself is the head of the church, the established Church of England. Destroyed a lot of the monasteries. All of that is over. And yet there's a lull, there's a pause between the Protestants and the Catholics. Obviously, Europe was descending into war, ugly war, so they put a pause to it. Council of Trent. So it's this peace, it's a very intense but worrisome peace. Is it all going to break out again? And if it does, will it even be worse than it was last time? So this is a time in which people are trying to come forward with a vision of an esoteric Christianity, a hermetic, an alchemical, we might say a Gnostic Christianity. They wouldn't have used these words, obviously that would have freaked the church out, but a deeper Christianity or a deeper spirituality that was very open to Judaism. The Holy Roman Emperor, Rudolf II, his personal spiritual advisor, by the name of Pistorius, was a practicing Kabbalist. How many Catholic Holy Roman Emperors do we have who listened spiritually to a Kabbalist? Not that many, he was the only one. So this is all brewing. And people can feel dark times are on the horizon here. And these guys, people like the Rosenbergs, the aristocratic family who owned Český Krumlov, the castle in Český Krumlov, they were the last trace of the old Catholic humanistic universalism. Yeah, they were aristocrats within the Habsburg world. You know, the Habsburgs, of course, controlled Central and Eastern Europe for many centuries. But they were committed to a deeper universal spirituality that went beyond sectarian divisions and that drew upon these ancient roots, that drew upon Hermeticism, that drew upon Kabbalah, that drew upon Neoplatonism. And you know, to get into that stuff, we have to go back to Florence, so I'm only going to do it briefly. It's another Open Center conference that took place in 2000 on the Italian Renaissance and the esoteric traditions. People today remember the art of the Renaissance, but they've completely forgotten the philosophy of the Renaissance. Now the Renaissance man, we know the Renaissance man, well, he was the original whole person. Before we had holistic people, we had Renaissance man. Interested in the arts and sciences, interested in the whole spectrum of human knowledge before we descended into this grotesque over-specialization that characterizes academia today. But you'd say one of the Renaissance men of modern times, rather than modern times, is Goethe, the great German dramatist, poet, novelist, scientist, administrator, you name it, what didn't that guy do? But you think of him as a real example of somebody who brought that Renaissance mentality into the modern age, into the late 18th, early 19th century. So the political situation here is that Europe is hanging in the balance, it's poised. Some people, like these esoteric people, are trying to find a common, deeper spirituality that can unite the Catholics and Protestants and can avoid the horrors of what is about to happen. And they find it, they go back to Hermes, they go back to Plato. And this is what takes us back to the Villa Careggi, the Platonic Academy of Marsilio Ficino, which arose in Florence. Botticelli, Michelangelo, these are names we would remember because they're painters. But actually the real soul of that was a guy called Marsilio Ficino. And you know, Europe had been really cut off from these streams, and then the Turks are finally threatening Constantinople. And finally the Eastern Church is willing to talk to the Western Church because they're desperate. So they send over their emissaries from Constantinople. And nobody, in the West, we've almost known almost nothing about Plato. But George Gamissos Platon comes over, considered the living Plato, the master of Plato and Neoplatonism. He comes over to this theological congress, the Council of Florence in the 1430s. But he said enough of just the petty theological minutiae. He decides to give his own lecture series. And so he does on Plato and the Neoplatonists. And who comes to listen? Probably the tiny audience just like this. But who came was Cosimo de' Medici. Tyrant, although a relatively beneficent tyrant, of Florence. And he loved what he heard. And he decided, you know what, I'm going to create here in Florence a Platonic Academy just like they had in Athens all those millennia ago. It takes him 20 or 30 years to do it, but they even designate somebody to do it. There's a gifted young boy called Marsilio, who's the son of his physician, and they make sure he's trained in Latin, not just in Latin, everybody knew Latin, but in Greek. So when, as a result of this rapprochement between Eastern and Western Christianity, Plato starts to come over to the West. So Ficino begins to translate Plato, and then in the middle of all the translation, this is a whole spiritual tradition from ancient Greece that has been completely, well, largely forgotten. We had Aristotle, but not Plato. But then on top of that, in the middle of it, they discover the Hermetica. The Hermetica, the Emerald Tablet, etc., which they discover in a remote monastery in Macedonia. I knew nothing about that. We had a Bulgarian guy with us in France in the previous year. He told us the backstory of how it got to Macedonia. So there are levels upon levels. So you've got the Hermetic, which they thought to be from ancient Egypt. So they thought they were getting the wisdom, but actually turned out to be from Gnostic or Alexandria, Hellenistic Alexandria, you know, when the Greek pharaohs, Cleopatra, etc., were doing their thing. So they thought they were getting that. Well, they thought they were getting Kabbalah because there was a significant Jewish community down in Sicily, and there was a guy there called Flavius Mithridates who taught Kabbalah to a close associate of Pico of Ficino called Pico. So you had the Mosaic, the Hebraic, the Egyptian, Hermetic, and then the Greek, the Platonic, all coming together in this academy in Florence, which seeded the Renaissance. And so when you come up, and years later, this is the 1850s, 1860s, so when you come up 140, 150 years later to look at the library of John Dee in Mortlake in London, you'll see that all of these books, everything that we're talking about here, Kabbalah, Neoplatonism, Hermeticism, all of this alchemical work was all understood and known by John Dee, who had a personal library of 4,000 books in like the 1570s, at a time when the library at Oxford was about 400 books. So these guys, they were in a different league. So I'm just going to show some more slides. Hold on a minute. I have to go over and put the mic down.
Ralph?
Yeah.
Could you repeat the name of the person who came from Constantinople that was attended
George
by...
George Gamistos Platon. P-L-E-T-H-O-N.
Thank you.
So Platon, yeah, he carried the whole Platonic wisdom. And remember, Plato was an initiate of the mysteries. So this is going all the way back to the Greek mysteries, the last time when we really had a living spiritual connection. We did the Open Center did another conference there in Esoterocrats for the Mysteries of Antiquity on the island of Samothrace. Samothrake, way up in the northeast of Aegean. The Greek government was so thrilled they provided us with all these things. Nobody had ever done an international conference on Samothrake before. But it was site of one of the most ancient mystery centers from 600 BC to 400 AD. The sanctuary of the great gods. If you have the feeling there that it was one of the last places on earth that there was a living connection with the spiritual cosmos. So Plato, as an initiate of the mysteries, and Socrates, his teacher, who was taught by Diotima, a priestess of the mysteries of Apollo, they understand all of this. So I think I'm going to read a little quote from Plato to you, just so we have a sense of this. I find it. Just to give us a sense of what was lost from the West for 1,000 years, something like that. This is from Puccino. Plato considers that our soul, before it descended into bodies, dwelt in the abodes of heaven, where it was nourished and rejoiced in the contemplation of truth. So the soul saw justice itself, wisdom, harmony, and the marvelous beauty of the divine nature. Those who were previously fed on ambrosia and nectar, in their descent, are said to drink continuously of the river Lethe, that is, forgetfulness of the divine. They do not fly back to heaven until they begin to contemplate once more those divine natures that they have forgotten. The soul flies back to heaven on the two wings of justice and moral conduct and wisdom or contemplation. It strives with all its might to reach the heavens, and thither it is drawn. Plato calls this drawing away and striving divine frenzy. So that's what the world of ancient Greece was really devoted to, divine frenzy, the soul flying back on these twin wings back to the spiritual realm from which it had come. But this whole tradition was completely lost to the West for 1,000 years or so. Let me also, now that we're talking about some of the great figures from Western culture, let me give you a little quote from Shakespeare too. Somebody else, because the Elizabethan age in many ways is the final flowering of this Renaissance spirituality. Full many, this is from the sonnet, Shakespeare's sonnet 33. Full many a glorious morning have I seen flatter the mountain tops with sovereign eye, kissing with golden face the meadows green, gilding pale streams with heavenly alchemy. Read you again. Full many a glorious morning have I seen flatter the mountain tops with sovereign eye, kissing with golden face the meadows green, gilding pale streams with heavenly alchemy. And I'll give you another Shakespeare quote now that I might be on the page that has it. I just saw a production of The Merchant of Venice recently, which is actually a really esoteric play. So the Shakespeare's just filled with this stuff. How did he know it? I mean, you know, the three witches, the three weird sisters who meet Macbeth, double bubble, toil and trouble, hail Thane of Cawdor. Who are they? They're the three Norns of Norse mythology. I've just come back from Iceland. The three Norns who dwell at one of the roots of the Yggdrasil, the world tree and the well of memory, and who weave our fate. And they already see Macbeth's fate. And I just saw actually Shakespeare's Pericles, which I always thought was about the Athenian Democrat, but it wasn't. It's a different one. But it's a whole thing about the mysteries of Artemis. Something else we did on one of our esoteric quests. The mysteries of Artemis, the Artemis of Ephesus. How did Shakespeare know that? Shakespeare obviously was way beyond what your average human being could understand. But here's a little quote from The Merchant of Venice. I don't know how many of you remember it, but it's Bassanio and Jessica, two lovers, Jewish and Christian lovers, who are meeting and contemplating the heavens. Sit, Jessica. Look how the floor of heaven is thick with inlaid patterns of bright gold. There's not the smallest orb which thou beholdst, but in his motion like an angel sings, still choiring to the young-eyed cherubims. Such harmony is in immortal souls. But while this muddy vesture of decay doth grossly close it in, we cannot hear it. So the old muddy vesture of decay, these earth suits that we're walking around in, that are just gonna, they may last 70, 80, or 90 years, but They're these muddy vestures of decay that close us in and prevent us from seeing the divine harmonies. But of course, that's the idea of the esoteric practice, is to get back to all of that. And one more little quote from Pacino, that love is the perpetual knot and link of the universe. These guys were deep spiritually, they got it. We don't have to just go to Tibet and India and Japan for all the odd, even to the wonderful shamans that the Alchemist Kitchen is so fond of. I think they're all wonderful. But in our own Western tradition, with people like Plato and Shakespeare and Goethe, etc., way beyond that, we have people who have the same level of spiritual depth. And that's what these quests have been about for the last 21 years, is bringing that back. So anyway, so what is the esoteric practice then of the alchemists? These people were trying to create a humanistic culture, a tolerant culture that transcends the split between Catholics and Protestants, and that's involving some of the most distinguished families of Europe, but that is in a very fraught time. Well, this image here, it's came out a bit muddy, but it's from something called the Amphitheater of Eternal Wisdom by Heinrich Kunrath, a great German alchemist. And so what we see here is the portrayal of an alchemist's laboratory. So, here's the alchemist. Yeah, he's in a state of deep reverence and prayer. Remember, I was saying for the alchemist, you don't just smoke a cigarette, put on a white coat, and go into the laboratory. You would engage in a sustained state of spiritual preparation. So here he is. This is a deeply pious. The word piety sounds a little damp these days, but this is a deep spirit. This is devoted. The alchemical prayers before they went into the laboratory, prayers of the highest order, very dedicated to the noblest spiritual truth. So you couldn't get further away from some scam artist trying to turn that into gold. And so there's the alchemist. Here are the musical instruments. This music is seen as a key to the hidden harmonies of the cosmos. And unfortunately, this didn't come out clearly enough. But up here, with all these different substances that the alchemist is working with, and here you can see his flask, his, all the different devices that are necessary for it. And here you can see salt, sulfur, and mercury. Didn't come out distinctly enough. But then what are salt, sulfur, and mercury? You'll find the difference. And this is where I draw on the insights of Rudolf Steiner, who is, if you want somebody in the West, and he died in 1925, but you want somebody whose work is totally accessible to us, it just waits to be discovered. 6,000 lectures, a million pages of comedy. I've been into Rudolf Steiner for 30 years. I've penetrated into it damn deep in its oceans deep. But you want somebody who understands all of this, and who's part of our modern Western world, and who left a phenomenal legacy like Waldorf education, the world's largest independent approach to education, biodynamics, the rebirth of organic agriculture in the 20th century, not to mention seeding the Campbell villages for special needs children, people into Steiner founding the world's leading ethical bank, the Trinidad Bank, and so on. Anyway, Rudolf Steiner is somebody who understands this, and he has a very beautiful insight into what salt, sulfur, and mercury. So, for the alchemist, as he gazed upon what was going on in his lab, you can see, you know, in those things down there in the lower right, you can see that's where he was actually doing these different processes. The alchemist felt that he gazed into profound dramas of the soul. Wasn't just looking at chemical substances going through transformation. Remember, as above, so below. The outer world, perceptible to our senses, is a mirror. The inner world of the human soul. So by by contemplating in a state of profound reverence, a state of profound meditative reverence and openness and focus, these insights could be revealed to the alchemist. So as he or she, there was a female alchemist, as he gazed upon the process of crystallization, probably remember this from high school, you know, when you first began to watch when something begins to crystallize out in a solution. For the alchemist, he felt that he was gaining insight into divine thinking. Divine thought itself. These alchemists, people like Michael Meyer, that they have the highest and noblest seriousness about them. They feel that they're seeing divine truths. So they gaze upon crystallization, and they're gazing upon and gaining insight into divine thinking. When they gaze upon dissolution, when things dissolve, they feel that they're experiencing divine love. And when they gaze upon combustion, so let's say, to go back again, salt, sulfur, mercury, salt is a crystalline substance, salt is the symbol of divine thought. Mercury, when we talk about dissolution and dissolving, mercury, was the symbol of that, in quicksilver. So mercury becomes then the symbol of divine love, or an element of divine love. And then sulfur becomes the counterpart to combustion. Something combusts and burns. That's giving them insight into divine sacrifice. So these are all, you know, profound insights that come to the alchemists. Possibly the deepest of the Rosicrucians. But here we're not talking about members of a secret society. Francis Yates adapted the term Rosicrucian. We've got all these people, Amorth and so on, out there in California. She's saying it was a certain cast of mind that can be described as Rosicrucian, characterized some of the most educated, informed, and sensitive people of the early 17th century, because they could feel the epoch was changing. And they wanted to offer this to the world. But they consider themselves the philosophers of nature. One of the names that the alchemists gave themselves. So Michael Meyer, is the author of the first multimedia creation of all time, probably. And this is from, you can see it just about on the left there, Atalanta Fugiens. Atalanta fleeing. And this is here the alchemist. You see him with his lantern there. He's following the footprints. He's following she is the goddess Natura, or nature. So they saw nature as a compendium of holy secrets that would disclose its wisdom if it was approached in a sufficiently rigorous and reverential and meditative and sacred way. And that's what they wanted to do. They wanted to bring together this scientific observation with the deep spirituality that went with it. Because remember, this is the last epoch where these things are joined. I talked about the people who were trying to resolve the brewing differences between Catholics and Protestants. Sadly, that didn't happen. And the Rosenbergs, the people who owned Chesky Krumlov, their dynasty came to an end. And then you have the nightmare of the 30 Years' War. See, finally, what was brewing between the Catholics and Protestants came to a head. And it really, I showed a picture earlier, you probably may have caught it. It's called the Defenestration of Prague. When I was a boy in high school in England, that we used to go with a trick question on history exam. Discuss the Defenestration of Prague. Knows anything about the defenestration. But the defenestration of Prague was when the new Catholic Holy Roman Emperor, who had replaced Rudolf, the alchemist, actually, there'd been another one in between. But instead, they were instead a super conservative right-wing fundamentalist, to use modern terms, Catholic, was made the Holy Roman Emperor. And he was sent, well, I'll show you a picture of it.
Do you really need this? Because I keep up to walking. Can you hear me enough to play shows? It's not being recorded, is it? But you're recording, John. So, does it still work?
I can hear you. Yeah, I think so.
Do this and the mic at the same time. Although maybe if I unraveled it, I could. Let's see if we can just look this up. So this is the deal. So what happens is that the Empire, the Holy Roman Emperor, send Ferdinand, this conservative, arrogant propagandist for hardcore Catholicism, sends his emissaries to the aristocracy of Bohemia and to announce that their spiritual independence is over, the emperor's back in town, his word is law, and they'd better obey it. To which their response was, they grabbed those guys and they hurled them straight out of the window. They weren't taking that nonsense lying down. They didn't die. They landed in a garbage heap. Some people say a dung heap at the bottom. So it cushioned their fall. But yeah, they didn't want to hear this kind of nonsense. And then not long after that, that led to something called the Battle of the White Mountain. Ilahora in Czech. When I found that way back in the early 90s in the immediate aftermath of communism. So if you ever go there, it's the end of the number 22 tram line in Prague. And you got to wander around, and eventually it's in a potato field. You can find a little obelisk or a little monument. Were you there, Jonas? Did you go up there?
Yeah, 95.
So, a little obelisk, which was put up by a group of Czech bodybuilders in 1920 to mark the 300th anniversary of the Battle of the White Mountain. The battle was, it's the showdown between the Habsburg Catholic forces, the southern Habsburgs, the Austrians essentially, and the Bohemians, who also had that over there, the Hungarians were fighting with them, and also a few Brits. But it's, you can go in Prague, you can actually see there's a scale model of the mountain, of the battle, just outside Prague. And it's really mysterious how it happened. According to Rudolf Steiner, the Jesuits used occult means, and certainly the Jesuit forces carried with this, traveled around with this enormous ceremonial sword. But it was a thick fog that morning, and the Bohemians held the higher ground. These guys were nobody's idea of whips. The Hussite, you know, they'd held up all these, you know, the papacy had sent all these crusades against the Hussites, who were Protestants, early Protestants, so they knew how to take care of themselves. Anyway, the Bohemians held the higher ground, and the Austrian and the Habsburg were coming up from below. It was a dense, thick, heavy fog. And if you had to bet, you would have said the Bohemians were going to come out on top. And suddenly, the Habsburg troops cut right through the Bohemian lines. And the whole battle was over in 20 minutes, in the middle of a thick fog. And it was a turning point in the history of humanity. And I guess it's mysterious how it happened. As I say, the only person who's given an esoteric commentary on it is Rudolf Steiner, who speaks about the occult means that we use. But I've actually never heard anybody really. When I've talked to Czech friends, people who Czechs who did keep the alchemical tradition alive through the years of the communists, there was a wonderful man called Vladislav Zadravilek, who was their publishing house. He published all these beautiful alchemical books, but he didn't speak English. He's part of that older generation. They spoke German, but they didn't speak English. So I could have a conversation with him through a translator. But anyway, that's what it was. It's a climactic showdown. Sadly, sad to say, the Habsburg reactionary counter-reformation forces came out on top, and there were mass executions in the Old Town Square in Prague. If you go to the Old Town Square, you'll see about 20-odd white crosses inlaid into the cobblestones of the Old Town Square, and that's where they were very publicly and very violently executed. The Empire, we'll talk about the Empire Strikes Back. The Empire struck back extremely viciously, and with the message, this is over, we're in town, Catholicism, hardcore fundamentalist Catholicism is ruling from now on, and if you get in the way, this is what's going to happen to you. So that's the defenestration of Prague that began this. I mean, also, the thing is, but what it really comes back down to, the karma of all of this, how did all of this happen? It's because they were looking for a new Holy Roman Emperor. And there were, it was actually an elected position. Various princes could elect the Holy Roman Emperor. And certain people on the Protestant side, who were also esoterically oriented, really pushed for this guy, Frederick of Bohemia, to become the new Holy Roman Emperor. According to Rudolf Steiner, who's one of the few sources who ever speaks about this stuff, that was a really tragic move. He was trying to go too far, too fast. And it was that installing Frederick as the sort of radical alternative emperor, the Holy Roman Emperor, was not taking into account Catholic concerns at all. And that's what really triggered all of this. And so, according to Steiner, there were certainly various esoteric brotherhoods that were responsible, not the Rosicrucian thing per se, but that were responsible for Frederick being installed there.
Frederick was married to the daughter of James I of England.
Francis Yates's book, The Rosicrucian Enlightenment, begins with a royal wedding. Who has a royal wedding better than the Prince? I mean, they've got it down. If you're a fan of royal weddings, which I can't say I have, frankly, but
The Stuarts.
Jones is pointing out the Frederick of Bohemia and of the Palatinate. He became what was called the Winter King of Bohemia. He was only king for a few years before this battle happened. But he was also the Count of the Palatine of Heidelberg, because that was the other great center for all of this. That's the castle of Heidelberg. It was also built, so Prague and Heidelberg were these twin axes, where the esoteric impulse of the Rosicrucian life was coming, where there were many alchemists. Heidelberg Castle was filled with marbles, it was filled with allegorical grottos, it was filled with speaking statues, and at exactly the moment when the southern Habsburgs attacked Prague, White Mountain, the northern Habsburgs, the Spanish, attacked Heidelberg. And both Chesky Krumlov and this place had great esoteric libraries, where a lot of the material that we're talking about here was widely available and was read. Unfortunately, it was all trashed. It was trashed, it was burned, destroyed, or it was transported off to the Vatican Library, and maybe one day it will get our hands on it. So it happened on both sides, that this beautiful, magical castle, which I'm told is, you can still feel it there if you go there. I've been wanting to get there for years and haven't managed it. But this beautiful castle on the Rhine, with its singing statues and its esoteric wisdom, that was a real place for it. So these were the two dimensions of the Rosicrucian Enlightenment, Prague and Bohemia. And there was a wonderful esoteric library too, belonging to the Rosenbergs in Chesky Krumlov, the little town of Southern Bohemia, and Emperor Alchemist. But that, you know, remember there were two sides in the 30 Years' War. Initially the Catholics were coming out on top, but then the Swedish king, Gustavus Adolphus, the Lion of the North, came barreling down to stand up for the Protestant side, and it was his troops who actually stole the esoteric library from Chesky Krumlov. when we did the conference there in 1995, we actually had a scholar from Uppsala, Sweden's leading university, who actually had some of the surviving documents from this whole period. So the whole Rosicrucian Enlightenment, you know, it ends. And by the way, we go into this horrendous 30 Years' War, basically from the defenestration 1618 to 1648. And by the time Europe stumbles out of that nightmare, some people think today that the sort of strong German focus on order is still a reaction to the incredible bloodshed and violence. I mean, the whole of Central Europe was just ripped apart. I mean, villages were decimated. It was just 30 years of relentless horror. think of what could have been had it not had the had things gone in a different direction. But that is what happened. And by the time we stumbled out of the 30 years' war, the modern world view, which is the mechanistic, materialistic worldview, you know, that there is only what we can perceive with our senses, and the total Cartesian split between body and mind, that had already begun to emerge. And I think actually Descartes, I think, was a soldier with some of the Catholic forces during some of these battles. Yeah, he was. So it's a tragedy that that whole beautiful esoteric period, you know, beginning in Florence with the Platonic Academy of Marsilio Ficino, all these esoteric streams coming together. You could say that the Platonic Academy at the Villa Careggi was arguably the modern world's first holistic center. Because all these streams came together, and we've had to wait a long time. I mean, now it's unprecedented. We don't just have, you know, the Orphic mysteries and the Chaldean fragments and all this kind of thing, but we've got everything today that enables us to do something like the Open Center. But that was when people first saw that all that there was a universal, well, they know it in antiquity as well, in ancient Alexandria, etc. In the modern world, the post-Renaissance world, that was the first time people could really see that there was a Prisca Theologia, a perennial philosophy, a universal wisdom that was understood by all spiritual paths and that had been fully understood in antiquity. So, so all that came to an end. Let me see. And we wound up with this really awful materialistic, mechanistic worldview, you know, the universe is a great big machine, and that our psyches and souls are totally separated from the actual external material world. I mean, it's been what's ruining our lives for that's why we're all here. Because it's time to get past that. And you know, most of us have been working on that for a long time with modest degrees of success, but we ain't doing too badly all at all. Unless, of course, something nightmarish happens, like the 30 Years' War. Let's see what else we've got here. That's Marsilio Ficino, the great translator. He was a musician there. He was a musician, a healer. That's Prague. That's the Hradčany Palace in Prague. Have any of you been to Prague? Isn't it great? I mean, you can feel the vibe in Prague, can't you? That atmosphere. What is it? You know, you go to Prague and you feel something magical. Yeah, well, there's lots of underground caverns in the Czech Republic. There's usually a bar in there now. But you know, the one indisputable form in which the alchemical tradition has been preserved unbroken through the centuries is in the noble art of brewing. Beer, Bohemia has the world's largest beer consumption and the world's best beer. Every little town in Bohemia, including Český Krumlov, has its own brewery. See, my Welsh relatives don't believe this, and there really is a place where the beer is cheaper than water, and it's not in the other world, it's actually in this world. Because, you know, normally when we do these conferences, we provide the water for free, but people got to pay for the booze. When we were in Bohemia, it was more expensive to provide the water. But, I mean, yeah, you get a frothing pint of fresh, organic beer of the highest order, but, you know, when I was about 75 cents. So that's why there was many an esotericist who repaired to the noble Bohemian pubs. that one went on late into the night. And there were a few pubs, weren't there, that actually looked, that had some fireplaces that looked like alchemical furnaces. So anyway, that's Prague. And you know, why is that magic? You know, why is there such a magical feeling? Just look into it. That's what these conferences have been about. To tune into one that produced that. That is Hermes Trismegistus. And you know where that is? That is actually at the entrance to the Cathedral of Siena in Tuscany. So a medieval Catholic cathedral has this. Normally, whenever I've been there, it's always been covered over with cardboard or something. So you have to get a postcard in the store. But yeah, that's Hermes Trismegistus there. The great esoteric sage of antiquity. You know, his Emerald Tablet comes from Alexandria. We did do another esoteric quest, but we partnered with the Library of Alexandria as an esoteric quest for the ancient Alexandria, which is really the Greco-Egyptian birthplace of the Western mind. It's Alexandria, the world's first cosmopolis, where all these different streams first came together.
Where another library was burned.
It's a bit in dispute. You know, I know everybody thinks the Library of Alexandria, it probably just went into progressive degradation after Hypatia was murdered. Hypatia, the last of the great pagan Neoplatonic mathematicians and philosophers, his father was the librarian, and she was a wonderful person. It took, apparently, so I'm not a mathematician, but apparently it took many centuries for people to gain again the mathematical insights that she would write, but she was a Neoplatonic philosopher. After she was killed, she was murdered by a fundamentalist mob, incited by the Bishop Cyril. And it would appear that it just went. So by the time Napoleon got to Alexandria, the late 18th century, there was nothing there. It was a little fishing village of 3,000 or 4,000 people. And the actual ancient Alexandria had either disappeared under the sands of the Sahara or had lived in various earthquakes and floods and so on. And so a lot of it had tumbled into the bay. But Alexandria is what gave birth. That's where Neoplatonism, Ammonius, Sacchus, Plotinus, originally from Alexandria. This is where Hermes Trismegistus' teachings first appear. And there were strong Kabbalistic elements too. So that's our man in a Catholic church, Catholic cathedral. So it just goes to show, I was speaking about the Rosenbergs and how the guys in Chesky Croton, how they were the last vestige of that beautiful old Catholic universal humanism. You know, there are esoteric writers like Athanasius Kirchner, Justin Garland has written a book about it. They were Catholics, but they understood this universal wisdom. And that's what the Rosenbergs were part of. And whoever put that in to the floor of Siena Cathedral must have been on a similar wavelength. It's all part of it. I mean, we've got a wonderful Pope now, best of my lifetime. Yeah.
Could you talk about the controversy about the time of Hermes Trismegistus, when he might have lived?
Well, nobody knows if he's an actual. I've never read anything that asserted he was an actual human being. I mean, he was. It was probably a title given to a series of initiates, of deep spiritual initiates passed on from person to person. But have you ever seen something?
Well, it was disproven, but when the Hermetica was brought to Ficino for translation, they thought he was a contemporary of Moses, but that was told never.
They just thought somehow had the wisdom of Moses, the wisdom of ancient Egypt, the wisdom of ancient Greece. But scholarship has since disproven that.
Could have been AD.
This stuff isn't spiritual and legitimate indeed. It just means they were wrong in their initial historical reading of it.
I think it was an allegory for the universal brilliance that Hermes is the god of the mind.
Yeah, you could say it that way.
And the books, like the Hybalion, that's supposedly written by the three initiates, they say this is the work of Hermes Trismegistus, but they're just channeling this.
Well, a lot of people claim to be connected to Hermes, but he's the great mystery initiator, the hierophant of antiquity, who understands the relationship between the worlds. There's Chesky Krumlov there, my beloved Chesky. If you ever get a chance, don't miss the chance. It's 3 hours south. If you're going to Prague, the last thing you want to do, or you're going to the Czech Republic, you don't want to spend your whole time in Prague. Prague is wonderful, but get out from beyond Prague. Go down to Chesky Krumlov. Now, it's true that when we did it there, I first stumbled across it right after communism, so it was totally uncorrupted. And even when we did that conference in 95, it was still completely modern. I don't remember anything about it that was commercialized. We did it in a beautiful old 16th century building that had been a Jesuit seminary, actually, dating from a time when the Jesuits and the Catholics actually had an openness to these traditions, like Athanasius Kirchner. But since then, the last time I was in Český Krumlov, maybe 3 years ago, or something like that, 2 or 3 years ago, the impact of contemporary capitalism is definitely taken a certain toll. That beautiful old 16th century hotel, it now has, you know, now the waitresses are dressed up as medieval wenches.
Oh, no.
So it's good for the, and the, you know, they've got big fake suit guys in, you know, suits of armor. It's totally fraud. You know, it has nothing whatsoever to do with the actual history of Chesky Krumov. It's just a, they get a lot of Chinese tourists coming through too, you know, who are not so familiar with Western history, so they can get away with a lot of cheap commercialization. The guy who owns it lives in Sweden, actually. So, but nevertheless, at night, even though the daytime, if you knew the old Chesky Krumov, it's a bit disappointing, but at night, you can, the vibe is still there. You can feel it as strongly as ever, especially after you've had a few Becherovkas, the Czech liqueur that is made by monks and is said to contain 30 odd medicinal ingredients, so you can get drunk and heal yourself all at the same time. That's what I call a holistic approach to alchemy. That's what I call an elixir. So that's Heinrich Konrad, the great German alchemist. Although they were all universal, you know, if you could speak Latin in those days, you could travel anywhere in Europe and converse. So whether it was Giordano Bruno or John Dee or whoever it was, they could speak to educated circles anywhere. That just shows you where Bohemia is, in case, you know, when Slovakia split off, if it hadn't been for the central province of Moravia, you know, Slovakia, Moravia, Bohemia, instead of getting a Czech Republic, if Moravia had gone with Slovakia, it would have left Bohemia alone. We would have had, once again, appearing on world maps, the ancient kingdom of Bohemia. Czechoslovakia only lasted from like 1919 to 10 years ago, wherever it was. So, yeah. So that's Bohemia for you. There's the defenestration. Out there you go. And here's another image of Hermes Trismegistus. You can see the sun and the moon there. And these kinds of mysterious engravings and emblems that appear.
Did the alchemists incorporate magic, or was magic a part of their practice?
Mm-hmm. I think there were different, my sense is that there were different people. Some people did that more than others. They would have, Ficino, for instance, would have been into natural magic. And so not the natural magic of just putting things into sympathetic resonance. So if you're wanting to produce some kind of healing, then, you know, you will pick a herb at a certain astronomically, astrologically propitious moment. So when all the heavens are aligned, so there'll be a certain ailment that will be associated with a certain herb, also with a certain mineral, with a certain set smell, with a certain music, and at astrologically propitious moments. So that kind of natural magic where you just try to align everything to achieve a healing goal, that would have been practiced by some of the alchemists. But something not black magic or gray magic or magic that was intended to manipulate the wills of other people. These people were people of the highest nobility and ethics, so they would have been very opposed to anything manipulative like that, like when, you know, the Elizabethan voodoo, where they found the pins stuck in the effigy of the, of, I don't know, of course voodoo is a wonderful bishop, it's just the, it's the stereotype of voodoo that would be condemned. So there's old John Dee. Dr. John Dee, now he's coming back on the scene. Who's the guy from, is it Blur or Pulp? One of those Brit rock bands. The main singer, I can't think of his name now. Anybody know who he is? Damon Albarn, I think it is. Damon Albarn. Anyway, he just did a whole musical based upon John Dee. I mean, somebody should bring that to New York. I would really like to see that. But that's somebody from the contemporary rock and roll world who recognizes it. There we have the philosopher of nature following in the footsteps of the goddess Natura. This is the, didn't come out very well, but this is the cover of Atalanta Fugiens by Michael Meyer. So Michael Meyer is saying, he's the guy that this is the first multimedia production of all time. In the sense that every time he has an image, like that one of the alchemist following the goddess, he's got a beautiful symbolic image. He's also got a poem, which is a sonnet or some
fairly sophisticated, it's a highly sophisticated form of poetry. And then there's also a few rhythms that goes with each one. Now I'm an ignoramus when it comes to classical music. Anybody know about a few? What would you say about a few? Repetition?
Yeah.
It's a round. It's a round. It's a delayed repetition.
Yeah. Which came out of those conferences, which you can say, which I recommend to you, the Rosicrucian Light. I edited it, or Chris Bamford and I edited it. Some of the best lectures from those two conferences. Jocelyn Godwin, who is, as mentioned, is one of our great esoteric writers right now. He's primarily a musicologist, professor of music at the Colgate University for decades. And he said, he tried, just as an academic exercise, to write a few. It's like he was exhausted after writing this one few. He said the thought that Michael Meyer produced 50 fugues, every which of one had a poem and an emblem associated with it. And that was just one of maybe 25 books that Michael Meyer wrote. It's a phenomenal achievement. These were people of the highest level of brilliance, as well as nobility of soul. So that's the multimedia thing. This, now we're getting into, and I think we probably should wind it up. So I'll just say this, we don't really have time to go into it now, but this is the whole question of the Rosicrucian manifestos. I mentioned them earlier, 1614, 1615, the Confessio, the Confession, the Pharma Fraternitatis, and then the chemical wedding of Christian Rosenkreuz. Now this was asserted in this psychic atmosphere where people can feel things are looming, there are great possibilities, but there are also great potential disasters. It is the end of an era. Signs are being seen in the heavens, etc. You can actually see them, and you can see the Cygnet Swan up there. This refers to astronomical or astrological constellations. You can see that we can't really see the Tetragrammaton right at the top there in that cloud. The wonder-working word, Christian Kabbalah there. Anyway, but this is said to be an image of the Rosicrucian fraternity, because the Rosicrucian manifestos announced the birth of essentially a kind of a new age, a reform of all world culture along these kind of hermetic lines. And it spoke about the creation of a brotherhood. They would not be distinguished by any kind of exterior garb. They would be healers. They would never charge for their healing. They would meet once a year at the tomb of their brother, Christian Rosenkreuz, for a certain ceremony. And they were basically dedicated to the renewal of the world. Now, did they ever really exist? Of course, there's lots of people today who think themselves as Rosicrucians. Francis Yates suggests that the whole thing was because of a ludibrium, it was a play. It wasn't referring specifically to a direct brotherhood. It was sending out a call to the, which was called the intellectual or the spiritual cognoscenti of Europe, just saying, it's time for us to come together and create a new culture.
Well, like what you're doing.
Oh, well, we're
starting then.
We're still
that was a perfect
today.
Start
never
for that.
Say die. Doing the next incarnation doesn't work in this one. So,
no.
Anyway, so that's all about, but that's a whole story. You can read about that. Actually, the Rosicrucian manifestos are printed in their entirety at the back of that book, but they remain mysteries. And that's one of the great painters at the court of Frederick Rudolph II, the Holy Roman Emperor, who was the practicing, well, he was deeply interested in alchemy. He's the one, Michael Meyer was his physician. He had a number of physicians, actually. But anyway, this guy's Archimboldo. So he does all these pictures of Rudolph using all the plants and flowers of all the different seasons. So he becomes sort of a cosmic, seasonal, planetary emperor. Remember, he's the guy whose personal spiritual advisor is Pistorius, a Kabbalist. Never happened before or since. Maybe the present Pope's got a Kabbalist as an advisor. Yeah. And this is, we'll just put it close to this guy. This guy is Robert Flood, F-L-U-D-D, who is a little later than all the others. He's English.
So he escapes all the horrors of what happened in Central Europe, the 30 Years' War, etc. He actually was very close to King James the First. William Paddy, who was the king's physician. He is a qualified physician, but he's somebody deep. You could say his work, in a sense, his emblematic work, in a sense, represents the apex of this. We're looking at the late 1610s and the early 1620s. So the nightmare's already happening in Central Europe in 1618, 1620 onwards. But in Britain, they're doing okay. And so there he is. So we see this, the mirror of the whole of nature. So it's a pity I don't have a pointer, but you've got the elements, you've got the four elements of the earth in the inner circle. This is what you call a European Renaissance tanka. Just like a Tibetan tanka, there's endless sources of meditative insight from looking at those symbols. This is a Western tanka. So where the inner circle has all the four elements in it, with different plants and all the different correspondence associated with it, the middle circle, the most wide one, is those are the planets and the fixed stars. And then beyond the fixed stars, the outer circle, is the realm of the angels. And the angels, the archangels, the archai, and as the tradition says, all the way going back to Dionysius the Areopagite, right, there are nine hierarchies of angels in Christian mysticism. So, we hear a lot about angels, maybe we hear a little bit about archangels, but then there's the archai, there's the dynamis, the curiosities, the exousiae, the middle. And then we start to glimpse again, then we get the thrones, the cherubim and the seraphim. It's the highest level of mega cosmic archangels. Now we think of the cherubim, we think of it as some plump little dude on a church wall like a cubit. But actually Rudolf Steiner would say that these cherubims and seraphims are the greatest cosmic mega archangels of love and harmony and wisdom. Permeate the cosmos, that we live in a spiritually alive cosmos. One of the most effective meditative practices you can engage in is to, when you are out in the country next and you're looking up at that night sky, start to imagine and feel it as a living spiritual cosmos. This is part of the work of bringing back the divine Sophia, holy wisdom, to realize that we live in a spiritually alive cosmos, not just a bunch of rocks and gases like that. Astronomy would indicate to us. And as I say, if you want somebody who carries some of this tradition today in an accessible format, Rudolf Steiner is your man. I would have not started these conferences, I think, without the combined influence of both Francis Yates and Rudolf Steiner. But Steiner actually gives us a whole story about Christian Rosenkreuz as a real figure. And as actually the seed of a whole new cultural movement. So you can think of Christian Rosenkreuz as the sort of patron figure of this esoteric life series. But there you have it: the inner world of the elements, the outer world of the fixed planets, the planets and the fixed stars, and the world beyond that, the celestial world of the angels, archangels, etc., all the way up. So there's a coherent worldview in there. It's not just some Renaissance fantasy. And there you've got some more of the same thing there. I've got to get better slides for this. And then so look, even though we had all the horrors of this, and it all came down, and we had the 30 Years' War, and we know we stumbled out into materialism and mechanism, it didn't all disappear. And one of the places it was kept alive was in Holland. Because when the Northern Habsburgs attacked Heidelberg, yes, they conquered it and they trashed the esoteric library, and everything that was there on the Palatine was taken. But in Amsterdam, in Holland, the Dutch managed to hold them off, which is why you have the whole Dutch Golden Age as well as the Elizabethan Golden Age. So, So this is Rembrandt. A painting by Rembrandt, and he, or a drawing, and he is the philosopher there, the scholar, he's having an inner vision, a Kabbalistic inner vision there. So Rembrandt was actually very close to the Jewish community in Amsterdam, which obviously retained the Kabbalistic traditions pretty strongly. So it did still go on, and it didn't die out. And even though it may have disappeared in the Renaissance, it did come back. And really, one of the main figures who brought it back was Goethe. And we did actually one of our esoteric quests. You won on that one, were you, Jonas?
Which one?
It was the esoteric quest in Central Europe from Renaissance Bohemia
to
Goethe's
Weimar. Yeah.
So Goethe knew this. He went through a profound health crisis. He was nursed back to health after he had a breakdown when he was a law student at Leipzig. And the woman who nursed him back to health was from the German Pietist tradition, Jakob Goethe, one of the other great mystical traditions of Central Europe, less esoteric but deeply Christian. And so Goethe had that
deep in him. Isn't Faust a mystery school in a play?
Well, there you go, Faust. Right. And you compare, well, you look at the magician, somebody was asking about magic. And, you know, you compare Shakespeare's treatment of a magician in The Tempest, one of his final plays. It's a noble portrayal of Prospero. Prospero is a Renaissance natural magician. He's a good guy, and he's working with seen in invisible forces, but he's positively presented. Whereas Christopher Marlowe, a contemporary of Shakespeare, he writes Dr. Faustus, and that takes the other view, which is that all magicians were lowlifes, manipulators, despicable, scum of the earth, you know, terrible people. So there was a real split between Marlowe and Shakespeare on this. And as Marlowe was murdered, it's a knife through the eye in a pub in East London when he's only in his early 20s, nasty days in those days. But then Goethe brings it back in Faust. You know, Faust is the searcher for wisdom, but he's the man who's willing to sell his soul to Mephistopheles in order to gain knowledge and wisdom. But in Goethe's, it all has sweet spiritual ending. It doesn't end politically.
And I heard Romeo and Juliet is also an entirely play of alchemy. Like Mercutio is literally alchemical Mercury, and she does teach the candles how to burn. She's sulfur, and the whole play takes you into the degradation, the putrefaction, and then everyone's redeemed by their death in the end. But the entire thing is alchemy, literally.
Well, you know, Shakespeare is filled. I mean, one of these, I was going to do an esoteric class. One of Francis Yates' other great books is called The Occult Philosophy in the Elizabethan Age. I really recommend that to you, because this is where she goes into all of this. This is where I got the quotes from The Merchant of Venice and from Shakespeare's Sonnet 33 on alchemy. I was going to do that about 10 years ago, 10 or 12 years ago in London. In fact, Prince Charles wanted to write the intro to the brochure. All he wanted was in return was a tape of Robert Blythe, who he was a fan of. But unfortunately, London was, at that time, it was like $2 to a pound, and London was just insanely expensive. And I priced it out, so we just couldn't afford to do it. So we did the one in Weimar instead. So Shakespeare is filled. I mean, if we ever do the occult philosophy of the Elizabethan Age, it'll be not just Shakespeare, it'll be Sir Philip Sidney, who was very close to Walter Raleigh. Walter Raleigh was a very close friend of John Dee. I mentioned when Sir Walter Raleigh was imprisoned in the Tower of London, he had an alchemical laboratory. His History of the World is filled with references to Hermes Trismegistus. It's the School of the Night. He was a wonderful poet, Sir Walter Raleigh, as well as being an incredible adventurer. And it's just that he was, the Queen had such a crush on him. You know, he was tall, dark, handsome, adventurous, incredibly brave, brilliant, a poet. You name it, he had it all down. But he didn't anticipate the ugly politics that would come with the accession of James I to the throne. He suffered a lot of intrigues against him and was eventually beheaded, totally unjustly. But he was a noble and amazing human being. Of course, he founded the Virginia colony here that was the seeding of the European population of North America, or the British population.
Another figure was Giordano Bruno, who was discussed by Francis Yates.
Well, that's a whole other story,
but he spent time in England with friends of sorry. It's Philip Sidney. And did he also go into
Giordano Bruno after he had his encounter with the pedants in Oxford?
Yeah.
Because even then, Giordano Bruno was a great Italian Hermetic philosopher.
Astronomer.
Giordano Bruno and the Hermetic tradition. He was burned at the stake in 1600 by the Inquisition. You can see a statue of him in the Campo di Fiore in Rome. But he wrote many esoteric books, and then made the mistake of going back to Italy, and then he was betrayed by the person who was staying with him. It's a long and ugly story. But he was one of the most brilliant minds. And he, you could argue that he actually embraced the Hermetic worldview fully, and that he really wasn't that interested in the Christian dimension of it. Whereas Ficino would have included the Christian. I haven't read enough Bruno to know whether it's really true or not, but this would have been the grounds for the Inquisition declaring him a heretic, because he really was embracing the ancient religion rather than something that's still in place with Christ, the primacy of Christ. So, it was a wonderful time. It's been forgotten. I managed to do these every here when we got 6 or 7 people coming. You think it, you would think that, you know, it was a turning point in history. A spiritual turning point of the modern age, more people would be interested. But it's not just out, it's because, you know, maybe I managed to get 100 people to come to Chester Cromwell, and a bit more than that in some of the other ones, but it remains forgotten. One of the reasons it's forgotten is because we do have this huge emphasis on Buddhism and Hinduism and Shamanism, and that's all wonderful. But it needs to be balanced by what we have in the Western tradition, which is every bit as wonderful, and actually more intelligible and more accessible to us. But only, you know, the only good thing to come out of the Chinese invasion of Tibet was the Tibetan diaspora. You know, you can actually come find Tibet lamas almost anywhere these days. So that wisdom has been spread all over the world. But with the Western esoteric tradition, you've got to excavate, you've got to dig. You've got to find it for yourself. You've got to piece together the elements of the golden thread. So, and that's what I have to enjoy doing, that kind of stuff. Yeah.
The Hermetic Library in Amsterdam that Roosman came to Prague.
Yeah.
And was that, were some of those volumes from that period?
Well, there's this place, next time you're in Amsterdam, you should go to this place called the Bibliotheca Philosophica Hermetica, the Library of Hermetic Philosophy. It's on one of a beautiful little canal in Amsterdam. And actually, I'll say something to really validating Dan Brown here. I'm not a fan of the Da Vinci Code, are we? But we just did a whole thing in the south of France, a quest last year. We didn't touch that stuff with a barge pole. We did the real stuff for the real Occitan scholars. But Dan Brown, I'm told, on reliable sources, just donated $500,000 to the Bibliotheca Philosophica.
Oh, good. They were in trouble.
Which is the greatest compilation in the world, I would say, of these old esoteric manuscripts.
Written.
Yeah. See, anybody can go. I mean, you might need to call to make an appointment or something. It's open to everybody. And, you know, it's not huge, but it's beautiful. It's deep, it's rich, it's amazing. I mean, they do have some really ancient volumes. I've been shown by the Rittman daughters who's in Spain some of these really ancient manuscripts that, you know, they can't make available in public because somebody could walk out of one of those out of their arm. Those are in a room at the back. But in general, yeah, it's really worth doing. And it's a wonderful thing that the city of Amsterdam has embraced this as part of the soldiers of the images like Rembrandt there, and the scholar having a Kabbalistic inner vision in the late 16th century. So I think that's about all I want to say. So,
great.
Thanks for coming. Well, the elixir kept me going, Cammy. I got more energy now than I had at the beginning, so I must be drinking something, right?
That's my favorite.
Which one
does he have? It's
the love potion.
No, it's the love potion. I made sure it was the love potion number 9, otherwise it might have been interrupted. The talk, we might have gotten distracted and other matters before we had progressed too far. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Rob.